You're listening to Rendezvous with a Writer with Bobby Jean and Jim Bell, only on LA Talk Radio.
Welcome to Rendezvous with a Writer, where readers and writers meet.
And story is everything.
You know, we're your hosts tonight, Jim and Bobby Bell. You've just been listening to Hot Texas with a Hot Texas Rhythm Man with our friend Alex Dormont.
Yes, yeah. And we're so delighted you're with us. This is episode 170 when you go looking for the replay of it.
That's a lot of books.
Well, we got 170, at least 170 books.
Probably
right.
Double that.
You are so right. We hope that you read with us, especially as we get into tonight's conversation. Jim, who's joining us?
We have Henry C. Park, film editor to West Magazine.
Hello, Mr.
And
Henry.
The author of this great book, Greatest Westerns Ever Made, and the folks who made them.
And then, who else is joining
Special
us?
Special guest, Paul Andrew Hutton. The Undiscovered Country. Absolutely blockbuster of a book.
And Paul, you can see we really read because we have a whole lot of post-it notes and places that we wanted to remember in here.
I love to see that.
Well, so we are... Yeah, we're so delighted to have you both. And Henry, I know we got the book to you last fall, too. And have you been enjoying? This is an amazing read.
It is a fabulous read. And I am just, you know, I'm a film historian. I'm not a history historian. So I'm learning so much from it. And it puts so much of history into a continuity and context that usually when you learn it piece by piece, it lacks. So it's terrific work, Paul.
Thank you very much.
Yeah. So everybody listening or watching, or whether you're doing it live tonight or down the road, you must buy this book, but we're going to talk about it in greater detail in just a little while. So let's see. Henry, we said he's the author of The Greatest Western Films Ever Made. And Henry, where are you joining us from tonight?
Tonight, I'm in Los Angeles, California.
You are.
You're okay. Back.
You're California time. Yeah. And then Paul, as we just quickly said, is the multi-award-winning historian and author of this runaway bestseller that we're going to feature tonight, The Undiscovered Country. And Paul, where are you tonight?
I'm in beautiful Cody, Wyoming.
Oh,
very good.
We'd love to be. Well, we'd love to be either of those places, right? Yeah. So, Henry, it's the first Thursday of the month. For those of you that follow us, we know on the first Thursday, Henry gives us the latest news on what's happening in Western film and TV with Henry's Western Roundup. Henry, take it away.
Thank you. I'd love to. Now, if you're going to be in or around Southern California between now and April 19th, I urge you to visit the Ronald Reagan Presidential Library in Simi Valley. In addition to the beautiful mountain location and the many fascinating displays related to Reagan's presidency, there is a must-see show, Cowboys, History and Hollywood, which I cannot recommend too strongly. Surprisingly, there is more history than Hollywood, with wonderful artifacts, beautiful saddles, guns, hats, the history of cattle raising, the history of barbed wire, mementos of Bill Cody, Annie Oakley, and one of my favorites, a skull-shaped ivory watch fob that belonged to Cole Younger. There's a gallery that looks at our three cowboy presidents, Teddy Roosevelt, Lyndon Johnson, and of course Ronald Reagan. Hollywood-wise, Clint Eastwood has loaned them costumes and guns from Unforgiven and the outlaw Josie Wales. Kurt Russell has loaned them guns and costumes from Tombstone and shot a welcoming video. The families of Roy Rogers, Joel McRae, and the Lone Ranger, Clayton Moore, have loaned them costumes and props, and the most popular display of all in taxidermy glory, Trigger and Buttermilk and Bullet. They're back.
Oh, they are. Oh. Yes.
Now, the True West with my article about the exhibit won't be published for a while, but our full article will be posted at the True West website next week. And if you can't get to the Reagan before April 19th, the show will be moving to the Mulva Cultural Center in De Pere, Wisconsin. Now, I don't know how many people caught up with the Netflix Western miniseries, The Abandons, starring Gillian Anderson and Lena Headey as dueling matriarchs in a story that has no awareness of the West and its history whatsoever. I never got past episode one. But for those of you who got through episode 7, spoiler alert, it ended with a big cliffhanger. Only one of the two stars escaped from a burning building. So wet and unidentifiable. Who escaped? You're never going to know, because Netflix has decided that there ain't going to be no season 2. Now, the January-February True West is our annual Best of the West issue. And in my column, I take a look at the best Western films, well, Western film business in general. And I call out what I think are the best Westerns of the year in several categories. The current Henry's Western Roundup features my interview with Bulgarian-born filmmaking sisters Biljana and Marina Rozdanova about their film, Eastern Western. And as soon as I can, I'll be posting the February Roundup. In the True West, I named Frontier Crucible the best Western of the year. And in the new Roundup, I interview director Travis Mills, producer Dallas Saunier, and star Thomas Jane. My newest piece for the INSP blog is Zane Grey's Western World, whose stories have been filmed more often than any other Western author. And you can read all about this and so much more at henryswesternroundup.blogspot.com.
Henry, we always want to sit down and watch movies after we talk to you, after you talk to us.
I was so happy when you told me that after you read The Greatest Westerns Ever Made, that you were making your way through the pictures I talked about.
That's really
exactly
fun.
What I hope people will do.
Yeah, it's a great suggestion. Just, you know, pick up a chapter or start with one and read that and then get it and then have it in front of you. So when you're watching it, like, oh, that makes it just all the more lively, right? Well, we want to take a moment, gentlemen, with both of you before we dive in depth into Paul's book, because it's so fun having both of you here. And you both contribute fairly regularly, right, to True West magazine.
Oh, yes.
And the last three issues, Henry just mentioned this one, January, February, but going back to September, October, we have these two charismatic gentleman on the cover, and this was a cover story written, I do believe, by you, Mr. Hutton. Yes,
that is correct. The
dancing horse. Which one is the oldest one there?
Well, this is the oldest one. This is okay. Yeah, this is the September October.
We had September. Okay, September October?
This one, the okay. one I just held up.
This is the one, you know, it has a list in there of the top 10 Western museums, and Buffalo Bill's number 2.
Yeah.
And since you're there right now, Paul, did you want to say a couple words about the museum?
Tell us about that fabulous place.
Well, I do know why it's number 2, because of course the Scottsdale Museum was number 1 and it's right there in Bob Bell's backyard. But let me point out that the Buffalo Bill Center of the West is a world-class museum complex. We have 5 different museums: the Draper Museum of Natural History, the Whitney Gallery of Western Art, a magnificent firearms museum, the Plains Indian Museum, and of course the best of them all, the Buffalo Bill Museum that I curate. And then we also have the fabulous McCracken Research Library, which is an incredible resource. It's one of the finest libraries on Western history anywhere in the world. And Cody is just a wonderful town. It hasn't been spoiled like Bozeman and Jackson. It's still the real thing. It's almost like going back in time to come here. In fact, I just learned, this is the biggest deal in the world, that I'm invited to be in the July 4th parade.
Oh!
Because of the success of my book, and they feel that it ties in with their theme, which is Legends of the West, for our 250th, celebration. And my grandkids are going to be really impressed. I'm in the July 4th parade here.
Oh, how fun!
Which is the high point of the year, the social calendar here in Cody.
How fun!
But anyway, everyone should come to the museum. It's just a fabulous experience, and I think it's wonderful for the whole family.
Yeah.
And, you know, we're the gateway to Yellowstone, so just put it as part of your Yellowstone journey.
Now, in this issue, which is September, October, we just want to also point out that right here, although you two gentlemen are meeting face-to-face tonight here on StreamYard,
you're both there.
You were both there
on the same page.
On whatever page that is, yes.
And
how fun is that? So, Henry, and in this issue, you had an article that was very, very interesting that was about, well, you tell us about this article for a moment, would you?
Is that the one with a century of tribal disenrollment?
Yes.
Yes. That was my article about, I was just looking at the new movie, You're No Indian, which is about the movement to try and disenroll members of various tribes, especially ones that own casinos, because it means that there are less people to divide the money with, which sounds very cynical, and it is. But what I found when I started looking into this was that, in fact, tribal disenrollment had been going on for about a century, going back to with the passage of the Dawes Act, where it became a valuable thing to be able to prove that you were a member of a tribe. And that meant, of course, that other people had a profit motive to disprove your membership. And that's what the article is about. And it's funny because some ancestors of my wife were caught up in this.
Mm-hmm.
So, it was it's a fascinating subject. And in fact, I am working on a book on it.
Oh, that's exciting, okay. Henry. Well, and then as we mentioned, you had the cover story in this issue. Do you want to speak just for a moment about that story, Paul?
Sure. It's a distillation out of one of the chapters of the book, The Undiscovered Country, and it's called The Dancing Horse, and it's the story of the death of Sitting Bull and how Buffalo Bill attempted to save him, but was thwarted by the machinations of the Indian Bureau. And then Sitting Bull was, of course, essentially assassinated during the arrest. And Buffalo Bill himself said it was cold-blooded murder. Mm-hmm. And just a great tragedy. And the wonderful story that's connected with him is Cody had given Sitting Bull the gray prancing horse that he had ridden in the arena during his mm-hmm. season with the Wild West. And that horse had been trained to dance to the mm-hmm. guns going off. Yeah. And when they were bringing Sitting Bull out of his cabin, and the horse had been saddled for him to be put on during this arrest by the native police force, all hell just broke loose. Shots were fired. Sitting Bull was killed immediately. And then the horse began to dance. And, the firing stopped for a few seconds, and then it began again. But the talk about a real ghost dance. I mean, this was, I just thought, such a powerfully symbolic moment marking the end of a way of life.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, the dancing horse is such a great story. And then Cody bought the horse from the family, and it led the parade into the World's Fair in Chicago in 1893. So kind of a very tragic story, but a very poignant one as well.
Yeah, Yeah. Well, and then in the November-December issue, let's see, in the November-December issue was an article. Jim, what was that article about?
Well, Lucretia, this is Cody's rifle, right?
Yeah.
Lucretia Borgia. Well, there's a lady's name from the past, I'll tell you.
It was at the time a famous play based on work by Victor Hugo. And that's where Cody, you know, got the name. I don't think he was steeped in the classics or Italian history to know the true story of Lucretia Borgia. But that was the rifle that, of course, the 50 caliber single shot that he used to earn his nickname, Hunting Buffalo, for the Kansas Pacific Railroad. And it is prominently displayed in my museum. I consider it a piece of the true cross. This is one of the great artifacts of Western history. The stock was broken off years later. He had been hunting. He had wounded an elk, and he went to dispatch it, you know, by hitting it over the head and broke the stock on the rifle, which broke his heart. He loved that rifle, so he saved it.
That's you know, it's just interesting. Okay, now we had one more.
We have Daniel Blooms
from the current issue. And we, last time we were all together, we pointed out how many friends we have that are in this issue. But this one, again, because we've been reading Paul's fabulous book, this one got our, tell us, Jim, what's this one?
This is Danny Boone's, this is his personal rifle, and called Old Tick Licker. It's kind of inscribed on the handle on the butt of the rifle, and they did a lot of research to make sure it's authentic.
Yeah,
I think a lot of these firearms are kind of, you get duped with them.
Yeah, long rifle, is that right, Paul? Long rifle,
yes.
Is that the term?
Yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And you talk about, of course, Daniel Boone is one of the main characters in your book. And before we move on a little bit, is there anything you'd like to say about that firearm and Daniel Boone?
Well, of course, you know, Boone had many firearms. There's a wonderful story connected to it, which I tell in the book, when he was out night hunting for deer and they were carrying torches. And of course, he was an unerring shot. He never missed. And he saw these brown eyes reflected in the bushes nearby and took careful aim and was just about to fire his rifle when suddenly he stopped, and out from the bushes came a beautiful woman, and that was Rebecca, who would become his wife. And that's kind of one of those print the legend stories, Henry.
Yeah, it is.
You'll be familiar with those from the movies. But that was too good to leave out of my book.
Well, and that story made me fall in love with Rebecca, actually. I wanted to know more and more about that beautiful woman and her years with Daniel Boone, which we can talk about in a couple minutes. This is just too much fun. I hope you're having fun. Are you both having fun?
I'm having fun, yeah.
Okay, oh, yes.
Okay,
good. Absolutely.
We're going to step away for just a moment. Yeah. Are you a writer? Our sponsor is Blue Cottage Agency and Clicks by Madison are standing by to assist you, and they have a special offer just for our writing friends. When we come back, we're going to be talking more with Paul and Henry, and we'll be getting into greater depth about this fabulous must-have book. You need to buy it now. And so don't go away. We will be right back. Authors, welcome home. Every author needs a website, a home base for their brand. Professionally showcase your books and brand with a custom website landing page starting at $369. Bluebookshelf.com. It's a great feeling to be home. Contact the Blue Cottage team today to get started.
Welcome back to Rendezvous with the Writer. We're talking with Henry Park and Paul Hutton. And we're having a good time. As Bobby said, you know, Paul, we want to read a little bio here. Paul Andrew Hutton is the author of The Apache Wars, He is an American cultural historian, author, documentary writer, and television personality. He is also a distinguished professor of history emeritus at the University of New Mexico, a former executive director of the Western History Association, a past president of Western Writers of America. He currently serves as interim curator of the Buffalo Bill Center of the West in Cody, Wyoming. And he's won a lot of awards.
It's a lot of awards. You know, there'll be more coming, I'm sure.
We got a fun fact, and I actually took this from the bio you sent us. A fun fact you may not know about Paul is he's an actor. Among other roles he played, Dr. Paul Hutton, he played himself in the movie Naked Gun 33 and a third. How'd that happen?
Well, indeed I did, and I deliver O.J. Simpson's baby in the movie, and it was actually just like 2 weeks before the unfortunate incident with my friend O.J., and he was just frankly the nicest. He really was the nicest guy in the world. And then, of course, we saw another side. Although I will point out, he was acquitted by a jury of his peers there in lovely Los Angeles, California. Mm-hmm. But anyway, my friend David Zucker is a huge Davy Crockett Alamo buff, and that's the source of our friendship. And I had gone out to Hollywood and was working on a script out there for 2 years on Davy Crockett, which we finished and which we were paid $1 million for. He got most of that, and I got a very small part. But nevertheless, the movie was never made, which is a sad story that is often repeated in Hollywood. But while we were doing that, while we were working on it, he said, "Hey, come be in Naked Gun." It's, you know, it was the third of that trilogy. And so I play the doctor at the end that does the last gag joke where I'm delivering OJ, what appears to be OJ Simpson's baby. And Frank Drebin suspects OJ of fooling around with his wife. It was a real thrill, of course, you know, working on that movie. I got to meet all these, you know, all these stars, and it was crazy. Not only was OJ there, but his good friend Kardashian was often on the set, and Anna Nicole Smith, you know, was in the movie, and a whole host of other stars
that I would
be having dinner with. It was just incredible.
We have to watch it. Yeah. You know what? When we're off the air and we're having our chili, I think we need to watch it. We're going to find that movie. Yeah.
Yeah, I know.
I had six lines and somehow I was overlooked by the Academy. I don't know.
They know?
You know, if you have speaking lines, they got to pay you, right?
You know, indeed, I was paid, and I got residuals for several years.
Oh my gosh! Well, before we get into the book, we have a question for you. And we heard this actually from an interview you did with Bob Bowes Bell recently, and we were just somewhat flabbergasted. So, for all our writer author friends out there, it sounds like you write longhand.
I write longhand on yellow pads. Yeah. I used to actually use a fountain pen because it's the flow of the pen, the scratch on the paper that connects to the brain. I can't explain it. But now, you know, the gel pens are so good. I can actually write with a gel pen, although there are just certain pens that I have to have. And I buy them in bulk. Years ago, D. Brown told me that he typed. He was way ahead of me, even though he was much older than me. But he couldn't find the ribbon, so he would buy the ribbons in bulk, you know, because he had to have a particular kind of typewriter. And it's just a quirk, you know. And my wife, Tracy, types everything. And then I do revisions on the computer. I can do that. Yeah, but I can't create more than a paragraph on a computer. I can do emails and stuff, but I just can't write on that. And of course, I don't know how to type anyway, so it's pathetic.
Great story.
So, how many legal pads did you take to do this?
In case I do something, I save all my original manuscripts. I think, which will be great for some library someday.
Yeah.
In ink, and of course they have all my cross outs, and then, you know, I have additions and insert pages and all this kind of stuff. So,
do you write? Do you flip the page over and write on the backside, or are you just writing the?
Oh,
you know,
no.
Yeah, you have to
gel pen. It bleeds through. You right. Know, so you, yeah. So with just one page.
And then, right.
And my goal was always 7-8 pages a night.
Okay. That was
you know, I mean, the key to success at writing is to sit there and write. And, you know, sometimes you have good nights and sometimes you have bad nights. You know, I used to always write at night. I've kind of changed that since now I'm older and can't stay awake past 9 o'clock. But I now can write in the morning, although that's tough for me. And I'm always so jealous of my author friends who, you know, get up at 5 mm-hmm. and actually get to work and write and are done by noon. And then their mm-hmm. day is free. While I usually don't start till about 4 o'clock and then go till, you know, about 9.
Yeah.
And that's kind of the routine, but you got to do it every day.
Yeah.
Henry, what do you do when you're working on your articles or when you wrote the book?
Well, I do everything pretty well. I do a lot by hand, not longhand. I print everything. My handwriting is so dreadful that it was when I got my first little portable typewriter, a little Olivetti Underwood Letterer 32. It turned me into a writer because I couldn't bear to look at my words until I had that. So. The opposite experience for Paul.
That's so interesting.
Absolutely. I could not have become a writer if I had to do it longhand.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So let me ask one more.
Yes, and then we have to get into the book.
We do.
Yeah.
But regarding the interview, I thought that was a good interview that you had with Bob Lewis Bell. One thing that came out, you write with music scores in the background?
I do indeed. Yeah, I play soundtracks, and my favorite is actually I love Dmitri Tompkins' The Alamo, which I think is a really underrated soundtrack. But my favorite is How the West Was Won by Dmitri.
Uh-huh. There you go. Uh-huh.
And I was writing one day, you know, and scribbling away and listening to that soundtrack, which is so great. And suddenly I realized, oh my God, I'm writing How the West Was Won, although the book's also about how the West was lost, because it tells both sides of the story. But I realized that my structure was very similar to the structure of a web script for that film. So, and I wouldn't call that a great movie by any stretch of the imagination, but I love a lot of bad movies. And I love How the West.
Well, we're going to shift gears and begin to get in this amazing book. And congratulations. The Wall Street Journal named it one of the top 10 books of 2025. The top 10 books. That's just astounding. And I think, is it how many times now has it gone into reprint, Paul? Are you up to 4 or 5?
It's in the 5th printing now.
5th.
And I just ordered a couple copies off Amazon. They have a great price on it right now, and I do that so I can see what the printing is. You know, when I got 5th printings, which means they've sold out of 4th printings. In fact, the book the good news was the book sold out in 10 days. The bad news was the book sold out in 10 days, and there were no copies for a whole week. Yeah. And then it sold out again just before Christmas.
So
there were at least no copies on the internet. You know, Barnes & Noble had copies, Books A Million had copies. So people could go to bookstores and get them. But you know how folks are on Amazon. They want to push them.
Do you
suppose there might be some jealous authors out there?
No, not in Western history. No, Western writers. No, that's not been our experience. No.
Well, you know, I'll confess that I check numbers on Amazon all the time, and I check the numbers of my colleagues who are writing Western history. And I'm actually very happy when they're doing very well. I don't want them to do better than me, but I'm very happy that they're doing well. And there are several books out right now that are doing well. You know, Paul Hedren's Sitting Bull's mm-hmm. War, Pete Cousins on Deadwood, Brothers of the Gun.
Yes.
that's mm-hmm. doing very well. And all of this is just great for all of us, you know.
Yes.
It raises all ships. And so congratulations to everyone.
So, Paul, what inspired you to sit down and write this book?
Well, I mean, it's a long story, and it goes back to when I was 5 years old and became a victim of Walt Disney, like millions of other young Americans, and saw Davy Crockett, and that is truly what hooked me on history. And from seeing that film is why one of the reasons I'm so obsessed, I think, with popular culture and with film, because it's had such an impact on my life. And of course, I grew up in the great age of Western film and television. And, you know, 30% of Hollywood's product in the 50s were Westerns. And of course, television, only three networks, mm-hmm. but they were totally dominated by Western TV shows. So I just grew up seeing the West, loving the West. And it's all Walt Disney's fault. And then later, when I became a college professor, I taught mm-hmm. a course called The Western Hero. And I would go from John Smith to John Wayne in this. Mm. And, you know, Boone, Crockett, Carson, Cody, and then lots of Western film as well. And that then led me to write a couple of specials for the History Channel, because I've done a lot of television scripts. And it was called The Hunter Heroes. And I did Boone, Crockett, Carson, Cody. And that was kind of the genesis of the book. And I'd always been kind of percolating and thinking about it. And finally, after the success of Apache Wars, got the opportunity to, you know, do another major book and sent in that proposal, and it clicked. And the end result, after 5 years and much pain, what is The Undiscovered Country? Maybe it was Winston Churchill, I can't remember who, Henry might know, but said, if you want to write a book, it's very simple. You just take a knife, you open your vein, and start dipping the pen in blood, you know.
Yeah.
And write it. And frankly, that's what this book was like for me, and interrupted by COVID and all sorts of issues that went on. But nevertheless, it may have been painful, but the success is making it all worthwhile.
Henry, I was going to ask Henry if he had a
question.
Yeah, Henry, we know you mm-hmm. have a question or a comment that you just can't wait to say.
Well, actually, it's a question, which is, of course, your book tells the story of the selling of the West through seven people. You've mentioned Boone, Crockett, Carson, and Cody. And of course, you also talk about Red Eagle, Mangus Coloradus, and Sitting Bull. I was just wondering, who was number eight? Who was the last one you eliminated when you were deciding who these people were who would tell the whole story?
Well, it was a tough choice. And it was based on chronology. Mm-hmm. And I knew I wanted to start with Braddock's defeat, because Boone was there, Dan Morgan was there, George Washington was there. They're all, you know, major characters in the book. And I was going to end at Wounded Knee. And so I needed characters that could carry my story in a geographic sense from coast to coast. Mm-hmm. And then also, tell the story in a chronological sense.
Right.
And so I had my four frontiersmen. And so I had to make a tough decision. For instance, a character who I may do my next book on, William Wells, who's a frontiersman up in the old Northwest, who has fascinated me all my life. He's just a bit player in the story. So I had to leave him out because I went south and told the story of McGillifray and Red Eagle and the Creeks. And that was to tie in with Crockett, because I wanted to have a thread so I could use these seven lives to tie together the whole story of the American West, you know, from colonial times to Buffalo Bill, his Wild West show, essentially 1900. And when, the frontier West comes to a close. And I think it was something of a daring approach in terms of writing. And it's worked. It just seems to have worked. I wasn't sure it would, but it appears to have done so.
It certainly does.
You know, I was impressed. What kind of got me, I guess, I started reading, and I think, we're watching these characters grow up.
Yeah.
I mean, we got young Boone at 20 or younger, and as he gets older, as the life goes on, and several other characters the same way. We got George Washington. He's just a colonel in the militia, you know, before he really became famous.
Yeah.
I enjoy that.
I really got into kind of deep into the weeds with the colonial period, and I've had a lot of positive feedback on that. I was a little afraid that maybe I'd overemphasized it, but I felt it was important because I see the book as the story of America. And so having, you know, figures like George Washington as sort of major minor characters in the book, it really tied in the birth of the nation itself and the revolution. I mean, here we are at the 250th anniversary of the Republic and our independence. And I thought that was so important, you know, so I could make it clear that I wasn't just telling a regional story, but I was telling a national story. And of course, we go from the forests of Pennsylvania and Alabama and Tennessee and Kentucky all the way to the Pacific Coast.
Yeah. So, Paul, why does the West matter?
Oh, my goodness. Well, I think the West is just essential to our soul as a nation, our character as a people. And it really shaped the first epoch of American history coming up to, you know, the turn of the previous century. And what we take for granted as American characteristics that make us, you know, different, exceptional, doesn't necessarily mean we're better, although I think we are. But nevertheless, it just means we're different, you know, from other peoples around the world. And we're such an amalgam of people from all around the world. What gave them identity? What united, you know, people during a very difficult time when there's a horrible civil war, you know, and 630 Americans are killed in that war? Well, it's the West. It's the West that gave us a sense of unity and also a sense of national character and allowed us to reject the trappings of the Europeans and all they represented and the mess they had made out of the world. And not that we haven't made plenty of our own mistakes. I don't think quite on the level of the Europeans yet, though. And it allowed us really to have such a distinct identity, you know, as a people. Mm-hmm. And there's a Tecovas boot ad out right now that I just think is wonderful. And the narrator, as they're trying to sell boots, and it's a little kid's on a train. He's looking out the window, and there's a cowboy galloping in it. And the narrator says, we may not need more people in the West, but we could sure use a lot more West in the people. And I just
that's good.
Just wonderful. I think that's a
we haven't seen that one.
No.
Tagline makes me want to go out and buy Tecovas boots.
Yeah, we're going to step away for just a moment. I am kind of looking at time. We're having such a great time. We are just going to step away and tell you about one of the places you can order the books we're talking about tonight, and that is our Out West Shop affiliate on bookshop.org. And when we come back, Paul and Henry will talk about Western film. Don't go away. We'll be right back. Story is everything. Find a great one on Out West Shop's bookshop. Go to outwestshop.com. Find books and CDs on the menu. Choose Shop Out West on bookshop.org. Browse through featured authors on Rendezvous with a Writer. Explore curated book lists and our featured picks. Add in note cards, calendars, and jigsaw puzzles. One-stop shopping for great gifts. Use the search box to find thousands more titles. Make the switch. Your purchase supports us as independent booksellers. That's our story.
Welcome back. Welcome back to Money with the Writer. Special guest, Henry Park. Special guest, Paul Hutton. You know, Bobby said just before the break here, we're going to talk about film a little bit. I think, Paul, one of your favorite ones was The Searchers. Is that right?
Well, it is my favorite, I guess, film of all time, although I love films in other genres. And The Wind and the Lion that John Milius is one of my all-time favorites. I love adventure films, of course. But The Searchers, to me, is just the ultimate statement on America, on the West. Just such a powerful film, and it works on so many levels. And, I mean, I love the music in the film so much. The female theme in the film is the old Civil War love song, Lorena. And I named my daughter Lorena after the music in that in that by Max Steiner. So do I love The Searchers? Yes. And people debate, you know, what the greatest Western film is. I'm sure Henry has, you know, thoughts on this. And when I'm in a more optimistic mood, it's always The Searchers. If I get in a melancholy, dark mood, then it's The Wild Bunch. But
The Wild Bunch.
Henry.
But I think The Searchers wins out.
Henry, what do you think about The Searchers?
Oh, I love The Searchers. It's a wonderful movie. And, you know, for fictionalizing what was going on at that time and the story of people that were taken captive and the problems of getting them back, I think it does a wonderful job. It doesn't deal so much with the problems of what happens to those people when they come back after a long time of captivity. But there are other movies that do that very well also.
Mm-hmm. And Ford did one of those in Two Road Together, where he then deals with that very issue. But I think even at the end, and this is the brilliance of Ford, and Henry understands this, when Natalie Wood is being brought into the cabin, just before the famous scene where John Wayne walks out into the desert, but when she's being brought in, she's afraid. And she does these very furtive looks around. So that's kind of setting up that it's not going to be that easy, you know, for her. And so he's even touching on that, and this, that the kind of dark racism that dominates that movie, and the way the movie shows how this seething hatred, you know, that some of the pioneers had against the natives, and vice versa. Really, I think it is brilliant. And in Undiscovered Country, it's one of the things I dealt with. And I have some pretty brutal scenes in the book. Yeah. And one of the point I wanted to make was, well, this is why people want to kill everybody. Yeah. This is why you see this kind of racist exterminist talk. And oh my goodness, the John Wayne character, you know, Ethan Edwards in The Searchers is just boiling over, you know, with rage and wanting vengeance. What has happened to, you know, the woman he loves and his brother's wife and his family. So just
but of course, and as you're saying, that the hatred really doesn't come from what we think of as, you know, racism. It's all ignorance. This is purely out of experience on both sides, the terrible things that happened to, you know, both the white people and the Indians. They have excellent reason to want to kill off the everyone they can on the other side.
Okay, Jim, call out another film. We have like a minute. We can talk one more quickly.
This one, Days Gone By, The Plainsman.
Oh, The Plainsman.
You know, it's one of my favorite films. It's such you know, bad history. Almost everything in it is incorrect, although Cecil B. DeMille was such a fanatic for detail that in Custer's office in the film, the wallpaper is right. He's, you know, he took it from a photograph. There's a little statue that's absolutely off Custer's desk. And so, you know, that kind of detail is all correct, and then everything else is just kind of crazy. Although he did, even though he was the studio didn't want it, he does kill Gary Cooper's Wild Bill Hickok at the end. James Ellison's Buffalo Bill rides just too late there in Deadwood. And I just love those big, you know, kind of epic films. And there's always a certain quality of authenticity to a DeMille film.
Henry?
The detail, it's funny how you touch on the fact that they get the details right, that make you absolutely convinced that what you're watching is true, but then they can make the rest up.
Yeah, just totally me. And of course, you know, if my goodness, the most glamorous Calamity Jane in a long list of glamorous Calamity Jane is Jean Arthur in that film. Oh,
it's gorgeous.
You know, it's so great, you know, as a Western film buff, you see Jean Arthur in The Plainsman, and then years later, of course, you know, she's the faded beauty in Shane. It's kind of poignant, you know.
And even after that, on a lot of television westerns, she kept going.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, Jim, quickly. Okay, quickly, gentlemen. He's going to call out one more. Quickly.
We have, well, let's see. We got, how do we get this one down here? Joe McRae and Buffalo Bill.
Yeah.
Really, really just a bad movie. It was despised by the director, William Wellman, and by Maureen O'Hara, who stars in it. But it was a huge blockbuster success. It was in Technicolor, and Maureen O'Hara said that the in those days, people would go see anything as long as it was in Technicolor. And she was the queen of Technicolor with her red hair. And Joe McRae, whose grandson was one of my students, is just he's a fine Buffalo Bill, you know, and he's so handsome. He's almost as handsome as the real Buffalo Bill. Not, not quite, though. And, it, you know, it's one of those huge kind of pot boilers, you know, and like the skirmish at Warbonnet Creek, which was between Buffalo Bill and one Cheyenne warrior, Yellowhair, you know, now becomes this gigantic battle that takes place. And so playing pretty fast and loose with historical facts. And the Wild West show, for which Bill is so famous, is just right at the very end. And he's saying goodbye to the audience, and he says, "God bless you all." And a little crippled boy rises up and says, "God bless you, Buffalo Bill." And Wellman hated that scene so much, he said he almost threw up.
Oh,
and
my gosh.
Like, he had a more cynical
view of Bill, I guess. And so in later years, when someone would say something really stupid or he'd be angry, he'd just say, "God bless you, Buffalo Bill."
Oh, okay.
Kind of like bless your heart.
You know? Well, Paul and Henry, we really want to thank you for being with us tonight. This was just so delightful. And to our listeners and watchers, truly, once again, we couldn't put this book down. It is a marvel. It is a delight. It's like reading a novel. And it's just full of fabulous, engaging characters and situations, and it absolutely must be on your reading list. Gentlemen, very quickly, Paul, where can people find you, follow you?
PaulHutton.com, and I am on Facebook as well.
All right. And Henry, we'll see you next month with Bob Bozbell and Stuart Rosebrook. And where can people find and follow you?
Oh, they can find me every issue of True West, and you can catch my articles for the INSP channel at the INSP blog, and of course at Henry's Western Roundup at henryswesternroundup.com.
All right. Jim, do you have a quote?
We have a quote.
We have a quote.
Well, we took this from the book, and this is from Daniel Boone, and he's near the end of his days. End of his life, and he says, "Many heroic actions and chivalrous adventures are related of me and only exist in regions of fancy. With me, the world has taken great liberties, and yet I have been but a common man." We thought that was pretty good. We thought it.
I liked his wife. Yeah. Well, we really want to thank you again for joining us for tonight, episode 170. And to our special guests, Henry Park and Paul Hutton. We also want to say congratulations to Sam Hassan, the owner of LA Talk Radio, who makes this all happen. This is LA Talk Radio is entering its 19th year this week. He has been a pioneer in podcasting before anybody ever used the term. And congratulations to Sam. We want to thank Blue Cottage Agency and Clicks by Madison, our sponsors, and Alex Dormont and the Hot Texas Swing Band. Next week, we have another really wonderful rendezvous lined up. I read this on the train. Could not put it down. Did not sleep. The River Ghost. This is by Thomas Claggett. He joins us next week. He's a fellow New Mexican. I think he calls Santa Fe home. This is an amazing, he calls it a Gothic Western. You will not be able to put it down. So join us next week. Jim, do you have a closing thought?
Again, thank you folks for being with us tonight. And as we always say, it's always a great day out west.
Keep writing.
We'll keep reading.
And we'll see you down the trail. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Thanks, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Happy trails.
Happy trails. Yeah.